Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In which the global economy is explained by Chuck E. Cheese, Pinterest, Bitcoin, and the federal bankruptcy code. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is Monday, the 8th of April today. Now, here is a phrase that will strike fear into the hearts of many a parent out there. Chuck E. Cheese. I know, right? Although, it's entirely possible that same phrase will bring up joyous memories from many a younger listener out there. I mention it because the private equity firm that took Chuck private 4 years ago announced today it is taking the restaurant and amusement company public again. Ticker symbol, by the way, CEC. Very clever. All of that by way of introduction to this, that 2019 is shaping up to be quite the IPO year. Pinterest sent the price range for its public offering today, an $11 billion valuation, give or take. There was Lyft a couple of weeks ago, Uber, Slack, and Postmates still to come. It is looking to be the biggest wave of IPOs since the dot-com boom 20 years ago, which ended altogether now with the dot-com bust. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looked into how the class of 19 stacks up against the alumni of 99.
Let's go back to 1999. Not that part. This part.
Today, I'm overseeing some deliveries for Pets.com.
Space Rite Aid is going to own 25.3% of drugstore.com.
Do not stare into this index. It is white hot.
Back then, a wave of tech IPOs created a frenzy on Wall Street. Webvan, eToys, Pets.com, and other startups brought in more than $150 billion in today's dollars.
Investors started realizing that anything with a .com affixed to its name was perhaps going to make them some money.
Margaret O'Meara is a tech historian at the University of Washington. She says that atmosphere led a lot of startups that weren't making any money to go public and then go belly up. Today, there are fewer startups going public, but they're not that much more profitable.
Actually, the numbers are remarkably similar, in fact, identical to 99 and 2000.
Jay Ritter teaches finance at the University of Florida. He says the proportion of IPOs by unprofitable companies may be the same today, but the companies themselves are different.
Even though they're not profitable, they're much bigger, and they've demonstrated that they've got products and services that have a market.
That's because 20 years ago, the median startup that went public had been in business for only 4 or 5 years. Today, it's more like 12. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Hollywood, and by extension the entertainment-consuming public, that is, all the rest of us, have avoided, at least for now, a disruption to our omnivorous content consumption habit. We're talking here about writers and their agents. There had been a Saturday night deadline for the members of the Writers Guild of America to fire their agents en masse. That has been pushed back a week to Friday midnight, but the core issue still holds: writers' pay and who the agents are actually working for. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the very business model of modern Hollywood might be hanging in the balance.
A long time ago, Hollywood writers had it simple. They got an agent who got them a deal on a movie or a show, and the agent took 10%. Well, that's changed. These days, the big agencies take the writers, producers, and actors, package them together, and sell the whole bundle. And the agents get big paydays. Jesse Stern has written for TV shows like NCIS and Bull.
It's scary to believe that your agency might be set up in a way where they have a conflict of interest, where their agents are not capable of being directly devoted to your interests above all else.
The 15,000-member Writers Guild has voted to fire agents who won't end packaging. And that could deliver a blow to the biggest talent houses like William Morris Endeavor and CAA. Showbiz historian and writer Alex Ben Block.
There's four or five really large agencies who control by far of the most important talent. If the agencies refuse to give up the lucrative packaging, these members would go to other agents.
The agencies argue that packaging gives writers and producers leverage. And for now, these agencies are negotiating with the writers' guilds. But should Midnight Friday come with no deal, the industry could turn upside down, says Dominic Patton. He's senior editor for Deadline Hollywood.
Clearly, the nuclear option is now on the table, and there can be a process in which you will see scripted television on cable, streaming, and network stop.
So he says, be ready for even more reality TV if the writers exit. Or as some are calling it, Rexit. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Rexit, get it? Rexit? Brexit. Wall Street on this Monday, down, but not a whole lot of enthusiasm about that direction. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Latest round, and I'm pretty sure it's the eighth of U.S.-China trade talks wrapped up in Beijing last week. The agenda was basically same-same, intellectual property, forced technology transfer, the really big sticky issues. What is not being discussed much? Opening the Chinese market to this country's biggest technology companies. Facebook, Google, Amazon, Twitter, and all the rest. Their main operations as we know them in the United States just don't exist in China. So Marketplace's Jennifer Pack sent along this postcard from Shanghai, what a Google-less internet looks like over there.
The first thing I like to do when I get into the office is to check the latest news. So open a web browser and let's see, what do we have? News.google.com. Doesn't work, it's not loading. It says this site can't be reached. That's usually a sign that it's been blocked.
Some blocks are partial, like Marketplace's website loads fine, but the search function doesn't work. China's Great Firewall, as it's often referred to, helps the authorities restrict the flow of information in and out of the country. But on the streets of Shanghai, most Chinese people don't notice the absence of big U.S. tech firms, because instead of Google, they have Baidu Search, Baidu Drive, and Baidu Maps. Instead of Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp, they have Weibo and WeChat. Instead of YouTube or Netflix, they have Youku, iQIYI, and Tencent videos. And Chinese apps work well, like rideshare platform Didi.
Oh, great. I got a cab.
See you there, 师傅.
Didi crushed Uber in China. And Chinese tech firms have been innovative. E-commerce giant JD.com was offering same-day grocery deliveries in China years before Amazon even had the service in the U.S. To pay for the ride, I use WeChat, a super app that also allows me to book movie tickets or send documents to my sources. And as an official WeChat video shows, you can use the app to update your friends throughout the day. Except what's being said is monitored. And the censorship is getting more sophisticated. Like recently, we tried to send a GIF of a Chinese reporter doing an epic eye roll during a big Communist Party meeting. It never arrived for the intended recipient, and we didn't have an error message that it wasn't sent. So, when I make Skype calls and I want some privacy from the Chinese government or want to access the internet outside of China, I use something called a virtual private network, or VPN. This can slow things down. A lot.
Why?
Hello.
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 About 3 minutes into a call with my parents in Canada, the connection starts dropping.
Right?
You're breaking up.
Breaking up. So in these instances, I have to check if it's the internet connection that's the problem. Is it the VPN? Is it the app that I'm using that's the problem? Do I have to change servers on the VPN? You know, it could be a number of things, and the amount of time it takes to figure all of this out. I'm already, 14 minutes into this, trying to make a call.
Imagine trying to reach your headquarters in the U.S. or trying to share a big file with them. But there are U.S. firms thriving in China, like Apple. In exchange, Apple has had to remove VPNs from its app store, shift Chinese user information to a data center run by a local partner. It's the price to pay to access China's internet users, now 2.5 times the size of the U.S. population. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
On the theory that in this economy, everybody, well, we're talking companies here, so mostly every company deserves a second chance, we bring you now Chapter 11 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code, specifically why companies that declare bankruptcy don't always die. That's the title of a piece in Vox the other day by Eliza Brook. Eliza, welcome to the program.
Hi, hello.
So let's do the history here first before we get into the actual primer part of this conversation. Where did and why did bankruptcy become a thing in the United States, in the American economy?
Yeah. So bankruptcy, kind of as a way for companies to restructure themselves, dates back to the 19th century. And so it kind of came about because of the railroad boom. Basically, railroads were overbuilt. Some players necessarily failed. The railroad companies kind of lawyered up and worked out a system where they would kind of be able to stay in business, but their creditors would turn into shareholders. So they were basically trading debt for equity.
Yeah.
And that's where Chapter 11 bankruptcy comes from. And that's basically the provision in the bankruptcy code that allows companies to restructure rather than just liquidating and going out of business.
And the catch is really that these companies, bankrupt though they may be, there has to be a legitimate reason for them to continue to exist in some way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah. So this is something that sounds so basic, but companies do need a reason to be in business. And so that's kind of the question that they're asking themselves when they're thinking about, you know, do we want to restructure? Do we want to liquidate? Are they going into bankruptcy because they have too much debt, but they still have, you know, strong sales, or have all their customers left them? You know, in that case, maybe, you know, restructuring isn't the way to go.
And that's the modern retailer versus Amazon thing, right? I mean, modern retailers are having a tough time because in some way, shape, or form, because in some way, their reason to exist has gone away because Amazon's there.
Yeah. And so this is the big reason why, you know, I've written about bankruptcy. It's come up a lot in the retail environment lately. Sears, Toys R Us, Claire's, American Apparel, Mattress Firm. There are a lot of retailers that in the last few years have gone bankrupt. And it's because, you know, these are retailers that grew by expanding their store fleets, by just putting down more and more stores. So they're kind of buckling under that weight. And, you know, a lot of layoffs. And a lot of them are going bankrupt.
Just because a company goes into Chapter 11, which is the restructuring chapter of the bankruptcy code, does that mean that they're eventually going to be okay? Once they go through the reorg, are they all necessarily going to come out?
No. And so that's the big thing. Chapter 11 bankruptcy often ends in a company going under anyway. Reorganizations very often fail. And so one thing that, you know, a lot of there's a joke I hear in the bankruptcy business, which is called a Chapter 22. And that's when a company goes bankrupt, comes out of it, and then almost immediately goes bankrupt again.
Is this a uniquely American thing? The ability to sort of go broke, as it were, and then sort of try again?
I mean, yeah, this is an interesting thing, and this is where it kind of gets philosophical. Bankruptcy, you know, reorganizing under bankruptcy, that is certainly a thing that, you know, according to the law professors that I talked to, has kind of been an American export. You know, it does play into this kind of American ideal of, you know, this being a place for second chances and, you know, that your history doesn't determine your future necessarily. That's kind of a mythology that has been disproven in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it ties nicely into it.
Eliza Brook writes most recently in Vox about the bankruptcy code, Chapter 11 specifically. Eliza, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
Hey, actually, you can pay your taxes in bitcoins.
Yeah, okay. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 83 points today, 0.3%, closed at 26,341. The NASDAQ up 15 points, 0.2%, 79.53. The S&P 500 up 3 points, that's about a 0.1%, 28.95. Boeing announced the other day it's going to cut its 737 MAX 8 production by 20%, following, as you know, a global grounding of that aircraft. world's biggest airplane maker, shed 4.5%. That was most of the drag on the Dow today, by the way. Price-weighted index. Look it up. Boeing's European rival Airbus gained 1.7%. General Electric down more than 5% today after J.P. Morgan downgraded its outlook for that company. Oil prices hit a five-month high. That gave energy stocks something of a boost. ExxonMobil gained 0.6%. BP up 1.6% today. Royal Dutch Shell climbed nearly 0.9%. Snap, parent company of Snapchat, up 3.6% after a bullish report on that company. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There is much news of immigration in the air today, with Secretary Nielsen on the way out at the Department of Homeland Security over her disagreements with President Trump on his favorite issue. Whatever does wind up happening with the president's wall and the other things he's promised he is going to do on the southern border, the fact is that there are millions, tens of millions, really, of immigrants in the American labor force. And the fraction of those immigrants who are here without documentation are often not protected by workers' compensation laws. Wyoming has the highest rate of workplace deaths and injuries in the country. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, the law there means undocumented workers rarely get compensation for those injuries.
A couple of summers back, a 25-year-old immigrant from Mexico was out mowing a lawn for a landscaping company in Jackson, Wyoming.
I had an accident. A coworker drove over my foot with a machine.
Marketplace is not using the worker's name because of his fear of deportation. In an interview with the Jackson Hole News and Guide, a collaborator on this story, the undocumented worker said after the accident, he was immediately worried.
I went to talk to the employer. He just told me, oh, well, for you, it wouldn't be in your best interest to do anything if you put in for workers' comp.
The employee says he did submit a workers' comp claim, though. But he says the Wyoming Division of Workers' Compensation denied it because under Wyoming law, undocumented workers can't be considered employees. It's the only state that explicitly excludes them by law. Wyoming's Department of Workforce Services, which oversees workers' compensation, declined to comment on any individual cases, citing state confidentiality laws. But the worker still needed to figure out how to pay his medical bills, which are now $2,000 and climbing. Under law, if he wasn't eligible for workers' comp, he could still sue his employer.
I went to two lawyers here in Jackson, and they told me that I couldn't demand money from the company, that if I did, the company would call immigration.
There is one attorney in Jackson who takes cases like this, though, Steve Dwyer. Right now, Dwyer's working for an undocumented worker, also from Mexico, who fell off a roof. His employer had been paying into workers' comp for him, but the roofer never saw those benefits, and now he's about $17,000 in debt.
His boss said that he would pay the medical bills, and then the medical bills got more than what the boss wanted to pay, so the boss cut off all contact with the person.
Dwyer says this worker, too, was denied workers' comp because of Wyoming's strict law regarding undocumented workers. Wyoming employers we interviewed did not want to go on the record to talk about how the law has affected their hiring practices. University of Wyoming law professor Michael Duff writes about Wyoming's workers' comp laws.
That's a very strange statute. It's structured oddly. It's hard to understand. And that includes how we define employee.
A few years back, lawmakers changed the law by leaving it up to employers to decide if their workers are here legally. Now, if the employer believes that the worker's paperwork seems legit, then sure, that worker can receive workers' comp.
In my experience, I think the law as written works pretty well.
Jason Wolf is with Wyoming Workforce Services.
I think we are, in a sense, including the undocumented workers, as long as they're providing some verification to their hiring employer that they have an authorization to work.
Verification, whether it's legal or not. Debbie Berkowitz with the National Employment Law Project says that's a system begging to be exploited by companies.
It actually encourages unscrupulous employers to hire undocumented workers and then use their immigration status as a shield to escape full responsibility for on-the-job injuries.
Berkowitz says several other states have considered withdrawing workers' comp for undocumented workers, too. But so far, no others have. In Laramie, I'm Melody Edwards for Marketplace.
Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, the cryptocurrency really for a lot of more casual observers of that space, is an idea with more promise than practical application at the moment. Anyway, some businesses take it as payment, emphasis on some there. It gets traded, sometimes with abandon. There are certainly less legitimate uses as well. Oh, and here's one more thing. This year, businesses in Ohio can, for the first time, should they so choose, pay their taxes with it. From the Marketplace Hub at WCPN in Cleveland, Adrian Ma explains.
Most businesses don't operate in Bitcoin. So why is Ohio accepting it as payment? Well, the answer kind of starts with this. No, I'm not talking about this rockin' guitar riff. I'm talking about the subject of this promo video for a Cleveland-based initiative called Blockland. It's the brainchild of a guy named Bernie Marino.
So Blockland is a civic effort.
That's him.
To make Cleveland incredibly relevant in the blockchain space when it comes to business and government applications.
Did you catch that keyword? Blockchain. That's the digital record-keeping technology that makes cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin possible. And although Marino is known locally as a car dealership magnate, he's also invested in a blockchain startup. And his mission for the past year has been putting Cleveland on the blockchain radar.
So that at the end of the day, companies move here and hire people. So it's about jobs, 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 jobs.
To raise the city's profile, Marino helped organize a blockchain conference in Cleveland this past December. Former Ohio Treasurer Josh Mandel was there. And to help in the blockchain branding effort, his office started Ohio Crypto, a website where companies can sign up to pay their business taxes with Bitcoin.
We're trying to do our small part to think creatively about how technology can make taxpayers' lives easier.
There's a 1% fee in Ohio to pay taxes with Bitcoin. That's cheaper than paying with a credit card, which comes with a 2.5% fee, though more expensive than using a regular old check, which is free. Still, some businesses jumped right in.
We're beyond the theory. We're in actual practice.
Jonathan Johnson is on the board of directors for the home furnishings website Overstock.com. It's a Utah-based company that pays a quarterly commercial activity tax in Ohio, and it was one of the first businesses to take advantage of Ohio crypto.
I think we paid the $35,000 tax bill. It was just a tad over 10 Bitcoin.
Johnson describes himself as a cryptocurrency believer. In 2014, Overstock started allowing customers to pay with Bitcoin, and it says it's collected more than $13 million worth of cryptocurrency since then. Johnson says about half of what Overstock gets, it converts into dollars, and the rest is held in a so-called digital wallet. So
we have Bitcoin to spend.
Now, it's worth noting that the state doesn't have a Bitcoin account. When a business pays in Bitcoin, that payment gets routed through a third party, which converts it into U.S. dollars, which is then sent to the tax collector. Still, Toby Sharding, who studies business ethics at Rutgers University, points out that cryptocurrency was founded in part as a way to conduct transactions free from government control. But now?
Well, here's Ohio stepping in and saying, hey, actually, you can pay your taxes in Bitcoins.
Sharding says this gives cryptocurrency a further nudge into the mainstream. There have been a couple of other states where legislators proposed cryptocurrency tax payments, but they didn't pass. Meanwhile, the Ohio Treasurer's Office says fewer than 10 companies have used the option so far, and they're not sure the program will continue long term. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which your results will depend on your own personal travel experiences. The 29th annual airline quality ratings came out today. From the bottom up, it goes like this. Frontier in ninth place, then American, Spirit, United, Hawaiian, Alaska. Southwest is number three. JetBlue is number two. If you've been paying attention, you know who's next. Delta was on top. Again, your mileage may vary. For my mileage plus, United, I'm looking at you, pal. All right, we're done. The Dow Industrial is off 83 points today, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, 0.2%. S&P 500 up 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special project desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.